Lecture 24, The Chosen People.
In the early part of the 20th century, a British wag named William Norman Ewer said the following: "How odd of God to choose the Jews." We're going to be exploring that idea in this final lecture and offering several retorts to Mr. Ewer. So, as is our custom, let us begin with some biblical verses that get at this idea. Deuteronomy 7:6 says, "For you are a people consecrated to the Lord your God. Of all the peoples on earth, the Lord your God chose you to be his treasured people." Seems pretty clear. Of all the peoples on the earth, God chose the Jews to be his treasured people. Now, let's take a look at another verse, this time from the book of Exodus, 19:5. Now then, if you will obey me faithfully and keep my covenant, you shall be my treasured possession among all the peoples. The word in question in these two verses is the Hebrew word segula, and that designates the special treasure or the special property of a king. Jewish commentaries on these verses vacillate between emphasizing that word's aspect as superior, because it's the king's treasure, versus its aspect of unique. It's not anyone else's treasure, it's just the king's treasure. And that really gives you the groundwork for understanding some of the tension in this word segula and the idea of the chosen people. Does it mean that the Jews are superior as the chosen people, or they're just unique and separate and special as a result of being differentiated from all other peoples? Also, as I emphasized in that verse from Exodus, is the status conditional upon performance of the commandments, or is it a permanent status? Let's take a look at another verse, this time not from the Pentateuch, but from the prophets, from the prophet Amos. "You alone have I singled out of all the families of the earth. That is why I will call you to account for all your iniquities." Ah, so that explains it. That explains why Jews have received more than their fair share of punishment. It's because we're in this special relationship to God. "You alone have I singled out of all the families of the earth." So it's not a relationship that bequeaths upon the Jews, according to this verse in Amos, any particular merit or any advantage. On the contrary, this explains why the Jews have been punished for their transgressions more than other nations have been punished for their transgressions. It sets up a kind of double standard. I should point out that this is a double standard that God can apply, as opposed to CNN. Applying a double standard to the behavior of the Jews or Israel. But there is another verse in Amos which gives us a little tension here, and that is in Amos 9:7. "To me, O Israelites, you are just like the Ethiopians, declares the Lord. True, I brought Israel up from the land of Egypt, but also the Philistines from Kaphtor and the Arameans from Kir." So in the same book, six chapters later, Amos says that in God's eyes, Israel is just like everybody else. So within the Hebrew Bible itself, we've got different understandings of what it means to be the chosen people, and even whether or not Israel has this kind of unique designation. We've talked before about the metaphor of marriage corresponding to the relationship between God and the Jewish people. And the corollary that just like a man can have multiple wives, God, similarly, as Amos says, has multiple relationships with the different nations. In one of the other prophetic books, in the book of Hosea, that marriage metaphor is highlighted. And there are some verses from the book of Hosea that are repeated daily by traditional men, and now some traditional women as well, who wrap tefillin, the phylacteries that traditional Jews place on their forehead and on their bicep. And in the process of wrapping them around, you wrap around the leather cord seven times around your forearm, and you recite the following verses from Hosea. "And I will espouse you forever. I will espouse you with righteousness and justice, and with goodness and mercy, and I will espouse you with faithfulness." Now, what's so interesting about this is that if you think of the etymology of the word religion, it means to bind again. That root, L-I-G, like ligament, is something that binds bone to cartilage. And so as we are binding ourselves with tefillin, it is a ritual act that concretizes the etymology of the word religion. We're binding ourselves to God every day in this act of love by saying these words of love that are then repeated by the groom at the moment of his wedding underneath the chuppah, underneath the marriage canopy. So we leave the biblical world with an understanding that there is this sacred relationship, there is this special relationship between God and the Jewish people. We are the Am Segula, the treasured people, the chosen people. But does that mean that we are special and different, or does that mean that we are superior? When we move into the rabbinic period, what needs to be said immediately is that the concept of the chosen people was adopted by the rabbis and canonized within the liturgy, so that on every Shabbat and for every holiday, the Jews say to themselves that we are the chosen people. Now, how they understand what it means to be the chosen people is up for interpretation. But the idea of the Jews being the chosen people is canonized by the rabbi in their liturgy. Nevertheless, there were some rabbis that were uncomfortable with the idea, and we have a few rabbinic statements that display that discomfort. One of my favorite pieces of Agadah is the following. We have the image of God coming to one of the ancient peoples, let's say the Moabites. And God says, "Hey, you Moabites, you guys interested in my book, the Torah?" And the Moabites say, "Well, I don't know. Tell me about it. What's in your book, the Torah?" And God says, "Well, amongst other things, it says, do not murder." And the Moabites say, "Whoa, whoa, whoa. We're not going to sign on to do not murder. We're all about murder. We love to murder. We are bloodthirsty people. Sorry, go shop your Torah someplace else." So God goes, okay. So he walks around to another ancient Near Eastern group, say the Perizzites. And the Perizzites say similarly, "Well, tell me what's in your Torah." And God says, "Well, amongst other things, it says, do not commit adultery." And the Perizzites say, "Sorry, that's not for us. We love to commit adultery. Adultery is what we live for. Try shopping your Torah someplace else." And the Agadah has God trying to get all these other ancient nations, ancient Near Eastern nations, to agree to accept the Torah. And for one reason or another, all of these ancient Near Eastern nations say, "No, thank you, it's not for us. We don't want those kinds of laws." Finally, the Agadah says that God comes to the Israelites. He's scraping the bottom of the barrel. It's his last choice. God goes to the Israelites and says, "Would you like my Torah?" And the Israelites respond, "We will do, and then we will understand." Naaseh v'nishma. They don't ask any questions about what's in it. They just say yes. Another piece of rabbinic Agadah. From the Talmud this time. Every single utterance that went forth from God was split up into 70 languages. Let me say it again. Every single utterance that went forth from God was split up into 70 languages. This means at Mount Sinai, when God revealed God's will to the Jewish people, it wasn't only to the Jewish people, but everyone heard all over the world in their own language. 70 is the rabbinic way of saying universal. So all the 70 nations in the world heard in their own language. So when I first saw this piece of Agadah, I thought of an episode from Star Trek where the USS Enterprise had ventured into this area where there was a higher intelligence, and there was a message given by this form of higher intelligence, this higher being. And I heard it, as well as Captain Kirk, heard it in English. But Mr. Spock heard it in Vulcan. And then Chekhov heard it in Russian. And Lieutenant Uhura heard it in Swahili. And we finally figure out that this intelligence is speaking in a way that everyone can understand. What do these two pieces of rabbinic lore tell us? That the rabbis were uncomfortable with being selected. So they created the first piece of Agadah to say that the Israelites were the last ones that God wanted to give the Torah to. But nevertheless, we were the only ones that accepted the Torah. And then the second Agadah, about every single utterance that went forth from God, was split up into 70 languages. It's a very universalistic teaching that God's message is available and was accessible to everyone in their own language or form of expression. I don't think that we need to read the word language there literally as Hebrew, Spanish, French, or English. It can also be the person's mother tongue, the person's language, their form of expression. So although the idea of the chosen people was canonized by the rabbis, there are also many agadot, the plural of agadah, that reflect a kind of discomfort that somehow the Jews were chosen for this separate from other people. Let's now move into the Middle Ages and see how this idea of the chosen people unfolds. The biblical language of segula, of treasure, and the rabbinic endorsement of the idea of God having chosen the Jews led some medievals, particularly those of a mystical bent, to assume that there was something essentially different about Jews than non-Jews. There was something ontologically superior. Ontologically means in our very essence as human beings. This goes back to a description of Jews that we find in Ezra chapter 9, that somehow the Jews contain Zerah Kadosh, a holy seed. And this distinguishes us in essence, intrinsically, from non-Jews. This is something of a racialist description of the Jewish people, and it explains, or the medievals used this idea of a Zerah Kadosh, of a holy seed, to explain to themselves either why God chose the Jews, or as a result of having been chosen, the Jews were endowed with a kind of superior DNA, so that in our kishkas, in our guts, Jews were different than others. Yehuda Halevi, whose poem I read several lectures ago, was the first to articulate this idea in his 12th century book, The Kuzari. For Halevi, only Jews could be prophets. Also, there was something essentially superior about the land of Israel compared to other lands. Yehuda Halevi was a Neoplatonist. And if we remember part of what Neoplatonism is about, there are these different levels. And so in this hierarchy of different levels, Israel and the Israelites were on the top of the holiness hierarchy. Generations later, the Zohar in the 13th century, also from Spain, develops the idea that Jews and non-Jews have different souls. So within the mystical stream of Judaism, there developed this idea that a Jewish soul was more than and superior to a non-Jewish soul. It is repugnant for me to say, but nevertheless, it's part of the Jewish tradition, and I think it needs to be exposed for what it is. Also, I feel committed to exposing it for what it is because there are Jews today who belong to the mystical trends within Judaism. I'm thinking here particularly of Chabad, who still adhere to this idea that there's some kind of essential difference between Jewish and non-Jewish souls. Let's now leave the mystical world and come to the rationalist, Aristotelian, Maimonidean world to see what Maimonides does with this idea of the chosen people. In the Mishneh Torah, in Maimonides' Law Code, he describes the process by which Abraham comes to the understanding that there's only one God in the world. Maimonides turns Abraham into a philosopher who recognized by himself that the one true God is responsible for the motion of the celestial sphere, and that we shouldn't be engaged in astrological practices and worshiping the stars and the moon and the sun, but that there's just one God who's in charge of all the celestial rotations. When Abraham began spreading the word that idolatry was false, he aroused the ire of the king of the Ur of the Chaldees, according to Maimonides. And the king sought to kill him. Why? Because Abraham was upsetting the political economic order. He was getting people up in arms. And so Maimonides imagines that the king wanted him killed rather than to disturb the peace. So what does Maimonides have Abraham do? Abraham flees to Haran. And now I'm quoting Maimonides. Abraham then began to proclaim to the whole world with great power and to instruct the people that the entire universe had but one creator and that it was right to worship him. He went from city to city and from kingdom to kingdom, calling and gathering together the inhabitants of the world until he arrived in the land of Canaan. Now, for those of you who have Genesis chapter 12, verse 1 memorized, you'll start scratching your head because that's not what Genesis 12, 1 says. Genesis 12, 1 says that God called out to Abraham, to Avram, this was before his name change, and tells him to leave his home, and that Abraham moves from Ur of the Chaldees to the land of Canaan at God's initiative. But what does Maimonides do? Maimonides reverses it. Maimonides has Abraham leaving Ur of the Chaldees and going to Canaan of his own initiative. Why? Because he has figured out, because he is a philosopher like Maimonides. For Maimonides, by the way, all of the Jewish prophets are philosophers. They're necessarily philosophers. And Abraham is no exception. He's the first philosopher to figure out the errors of his countrymen through the use of his intellect, and he strives to enlighten them by spreading the word, by spreading the good news. So here we have one response to our British wag, Mr. Ewer, and this is not my own creation, but this is out and about in the world. Not news, not odd, the Jews chose God. In other words, it wasn't God choosing the Jews, it was Jews choosing the God. Here Maimonides represents Abraham figuring this out on his own. As we move into the modern period, we've already seen certain reinterpretations of this idea of chosenness. The Reform Movement emphasizes the notion of mission, found in Isaiah, that the Jew should be a light unto the nations, that we should spread the truths of ethical monotheism without having to proselytize, but just by being role models. That was the Reform response or reinterpretation of what it means to be the chosen people. But Reform Judaism kept that language. They still understand that they are the chosen people. And for the Sabbath and the holidays, the idea of being the chosen people is rehearsed in the liturgy. The ultra-Orthodox also keep the idea of being the chosen people, but they understand it, they interpret it in the modern era slightly differently, very differently, than we have seen in the past. They emphasize a division of labor, whereby it's true the Jews were the chosen people, but they were chosen to serve God through the study of Torah. While the Gentiles were also chosen, but not to serve God through the study of Torah, but to engage in worldly affairs and science and technology. And as we saw when we discussed the ultra-Orthodox, those endeavors of the Gentiles are no less worthwhile than studying Torah. But the ultra-Orthodox emphasize the distinction aspect of Am Segula, that, yeah, the Jews are chosen for this, the Gentiles are chosen for that, but no value distinctions are placed upon those. There is a Israeli gadfly, he passed away about 10 years ago, by the name of Yeshayahu Leibovitz. He was known as a very controversial figure in the state of Israel. Immediately after the Six-Day War, when Israel acquired the holy city of Jerusalem and the West Bank of the Jordan River, Leibovitz went on record as saying, we need to give that land back immediately with all the Palestinians. It will be an albatross around our neck if we don't separate ourselves from those people immediately. Turned out that he was something of a prophet, but the way in which he said it aroused the ire of many Israelis. He had this to say about the notion of the chosen people, also picking up on an element of its biblical formulation that up until this point in Jewish history, had laid dormant. The people of Israel were not the chosen people, but were commanded to be the chosen people. The Jewish people has no intrinsic uniqueness. Its uniqueness, rather, consists in the demand laid on it. The people may or may not heed this demand, therefore its fate is not guaranteed. Yeshayahu Leibovitz, like Maimonides, who was his hero within the world of Judaism and the entire rationalist school, eschews any hint of racialism. Indeed, the idea of being a chosen people is not a fait accompli. The Jews have to earn it. It goes back to that verse in Exodus, where if you obey my commandments, then you will be a chosen people. This is a charge for the Jewish people to behave in a righteous way. And Yeshayahu Leibovitz was constantly prodding and poking the Jews to improve their behavior. For Leibovitz, what it meant to be part of the chosen people or to have earned that designation was to fulfill the commandments. To fulfill the commandments. There is another aspect of the interpretation in the modern period of the chosen people that we must discuss. And that is the rejection or repudiation of chosenness by Mordecai Kaplan and the Reconstructionist movement. If today you were to open up a Reconstructionist prayer book, you would not find any reference to the Jews being the chosen people. What they've done is inserted other words where chosen people appears in a traditional prayer book in order to maintain a traditional rhythm so that you can still sing it to the same tune, as it were. But the idea, Mordecai Kaplan was very invested in having the liturgy accurately and with intellectual honesty reflect his ideology. And so those parts of the traditional liturgy that no longer made sense, like the resurrection of the dead, for instance, Reform Judaism got rid of that, and Reconstructionist Judaism got rid of that idea of the resurrection of the dead. That didn't seem to be anything that a modern rational person could agree to anymore. While Reform just reinterpreted the idea of the chosen people, Mordecai Kaplan and the Reconstructionist movement rejected it altogether. And he had four reasons for rejecting it. On the theological level, how can God choose anyone? We moderns no longer believe in a God who acts like a glorified human being and can select one over something else. So Kaplan didn't believe that on a theological level, the idea of a chosen people made any sense, nor, I will add, did Baruch Spinoza. So Kaplan wasn't the first person to raise this question. Two, on a psychological level, for Jews to consider themselves chosen might induce a certain smugness or complacency, or arrogance. And the need to have asserted such a claim in the first place smacks of an inferiority complex, according to Kaplan, which should be overcome in modernity. Why would you need to say that God chose us over all the other people unless you're feeling like God chose everybody else and what about us? So you make the opposite claim to compensate for your ego deficiency. Kaplan said, in the modern world, we no longer need to have that kind of complex, although he understood how it could have come about sociologically and historically, especially once the Jews were exiled by the Romans. And the emphasis on Jews being the chosen people compensates for them no longer having a homeland and no longer having a temple in which they would conduct their worship services. Now, one final response to our British wag, Mr. Ewer, comes from Leo Rosten, a Yiddishist, who responds to Ewer, not odd of God, right? Let's remember what Ewer said. How odd of God to choose the Jews. So Leo Rosten's retort is, not odd of God, the goyim annoy him. Goyim is a Yiddish word that means Gentiles. Actually, in Hebrew, goyim just means nations. But in Yiddish, it is often a derogatory term used to describe non-Jews, the Gentile world. And Leo Rosten's retort to Ewer, I think, exemplifies exactly what Mordecai Kaplan is talking about. In order for us to feel like we're superior, we create this chosen people idea, and to justify it, well, look how the goyim act, right? Look at what they've done to the Jews, and look at what they continue to do to themselves. And so, psychologically, Kaplan wants to eliminate that element of the chosen people complex. So we've got a problem on the theological level, a problem on the psychological level. Third, there's a problem on the sociological level with the idea of the chosen people, because such a claim may foster resentment and anti-Semitism. And indeed, throughout history, very often, before Jews have been killed or persecuted, there has been the taunt issued by their tormentors, "Ah, you're the chosen people? Let me show you what you've been chosen for." So this claim of being superior also arouses anti-Semitism from non-Jews. The fourth and final reason that Mordecai Kaplan offers for repudiating the chosen people idea rather than reinterpreting it is that the chosen people idea is anti-democratic. We're living in a democracy in the United States of America, and it's just not fair to those other peoples who weren't chosen. God doesn't act like that on a theological level. On a psychological level, it's no good. On a sociological level, it's no good. And finally, it's anti-democratic. And Mordecai Kaplan founds the first Judaism that is native to America. Remember, Reform and Conservative Judaism, they were transplanted from Germany. So Reconstructionist Judaism is the American Judaism, and as such, it is democratic, seeing God's image in all of God's creatures, and not singling out the Jewish people for any special treatment or designation. There is a quote from Malachi, or Malachi. "Have we not all one Father? Did not one God create us? Why do we break faith with one another, profaning the covenant of our ancestors?" I saw this quote when I first went to the Reform Temple in Nashville, and they have a mosaic by Ben Shahn with that verse from Malachi or Malachi underneath it. And it emphasizes this idea that we are all God's children and we should be responding to each other as siblings and not warring siblings or rivalrous siblings, but recognizing that we all have one Father. That puts the idea of the chosen people into a different context, into a different frame. Let me give you one more rabbinic quote. There is a verse in Deuteronomy 5:19 that says, "The Lord spoke those words, those and no more." That's right after the reiteration of the Decalogue of the Ten Commandments. It says, God spoke those words, those and no more. The way the rabbis read that verse, which was later canonized as the normative Jewish understanding by Rashi, who was the medieval biblical commentator par excellence, was to see that verb and no more and to repunctuate the vowels underneath the three consonants, Yud, Samech, Peh, and to read it as, "The Lord spoke those words and did not stop." God's word continued to come from God. Just the opposite of what the plain sense means, it is true, but without adding any letters or subtracting any letters, just with reconfiguring the points under the letters, the vowels, the rabbis came up with this idea that God's revelation never ceases. A Hasidic rabbi, Rabbi Menachem Mendel of Kotsk, in the 19th century, in the early 19th century, said, "The giving of the Torah took place at Shavuot, but the receiving of the Torah takes place every day. The giving of the Torah was the same for everyone, but the receiving of the Torah is different for everyone according to his capacity." The name Yisrael means one who struggles with God. We find that with Jacob struggling with the angel who's representing God. For all of us who claim to be spiritual heirs of Yisrael, we are charged with the struggle of receiving the Torah and responding to it according to our own individual capacity, in our own language and our form of expression. The story of Judaism is the story of the struggle to respond appropriately to the gracious love, the harsh justice, and the all-pervading unity to which our lives and this grand universe testify. The Judaisms we've examined in this course reflect the ongoing struggles of the Jewish people from their ancient life as a sovereign nation, to the travails of exile, to the opportunities of acculturation in modernity, and finally to the reestablishment of the State of Israel. Hearing God's words anew, receiving Torah every day, has meant reinterpreting the tradition, creatively rereading the words of the past, whether they relate to core ideas like notions of evil and the chosen people, or mitzvot, such as the prohibition of idolatry or the laws of marriage and divorce. Even the basis for reinterpreting the tradition, the claim that God's words do not cease, is itself a rereading of Torah. I'm Shai Cherry. Thank you for joining me in the Teaching Company's Introduction to Judaism.
We hope you've enjoyed these lectures from our Great Courses series. Our courses are available to order online. Visit our website at www.teach12.com or call our customer care representatives at 1-800-TEACH-12. That's 1-800-TEACH-12. Thank you very much.